You're listening to the Apparently Parent podcast. My name is Ron Katz, and today one of my favorite guests is coming back to the show. So stick around, this is going to be good. You're listening to the Apparently Parent podcast, where we combine the art of parenting with the science of psychology. I'm Ron Katz, and for over 10 years as a clinical psychologist, I've been helping people from age 6 to 86 live a happier, more flexible life. In the process, I have learned about the things parents do to make or break a childhood, and what turns children into happy, confident human beings. This podcast is for you, the 21st century parent who believes that better parenting can make a better world. So if that's you, and you're ready to elevate your parenting journey, let's go! I'm your host, Ron Katz. All right, my friends, welcome again to the Apparently Parent podcast. And today we have something fun. We have a returning guest for the first time here on this show. You heard her before, and we're going to talk again. So she's an author, she's an editor, a researcher, she's a writing coach, she's a Zen student, she's a mom, she's a dog lover. And last but not least, the first returning guest on the show, which means she's inaugurating the Two Timers Club, and she is Bethany Saltman. Hi, Bethany.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming back. Yeah.
My pleasure.
So we were just catching up a little bit before we hit record, and I would just want to say to our listeners that we're recording this on April 22nd. So when you guys listen to this episode, it's going to be a little later in the year. We are gathered here because we're celebrating your book, which just came out 2 days ago, I believe, in paperback.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Sir. So first, congratulations.
Thank you.
We talked a little bit about your book in a previous chat, but let me tell you a little bit about it. It's called Strange Situation. And I forgot the tagline. It's A Mother's Journey
Into the Science of Attachment.
Yeah. And I can't recommend this book enough. It's one of my favorites. I read it on Kindle, and now I like to read on paperbacks as well. So I'm waiting for it to be shipped here to Israel.
Yay.
And so first, congratulations for this paper. I know, as someone who has never published a book yet, I wonder what it feels like to have it. It's the book that you already published, but it's like in another, it's a new cover, it's another edition. What does it feel like?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, it feels a little like not that big of a deal. I'm so delighted that Random House wanted to bring it out again. So I'm really proud, but it is so nothing compared to the first time. Which was a huge deal. I'd been working on this book for 10 years. I had been working on getting a book published my whole adult life, basically. And then COVID hit, and right when that happened. And so the biggest party of my life got canceled, and it was just a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
So it's been a big year of sort of, sorting all of that out. And so now the paperback is here, and it feels very nice, but it's not, it doesn't compare to the, tumultuous agony and the ecstasy of the first round.
So it's not like having a child and then another child.
No, it's like a child, and then the child has like their 2.5 birthday or something.
Okay. We sometimes do those.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Okay, cool.
But I'm so proud. I'm still really proud.
And just for the sake of the listeners who didn't listen to our previous chat, I'll tell a little bit about this book. So this book is actually a mixture, the way I see it, a mixture of a memoir and parenting, not a parenting guiding book, but a book about being a parent. And I remember in a previous episode, I think I dubbed it as the story of three mothers. It's the story of Mary Ainsworth, and maybe you want to talk a little bit about who she was, and the story of the mother that you grew up to be, and also the story of your own mom, as I remember correctly, because you share a lot about your own childhood and your own history of growing up and how it affected you and your own journey into motherhood, and all of that under the umbrella of you discovering
attachment and attachment theory and the work of Mary Ainsworth. So
yes,
it's that's why I think it's so fascinating, because it's such a personal and touching story. And also you learn a lot about attachment, and you learn a lot about Mary Ainsworth, which is really, really nice.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I remember our last conversation was one of my favorite. I was doing a lot of podcasts at that time, and I loved the way you talked about the three mothers. And interestingly, Mary Ainsworth was not actually a mother. She gave birth, of course, to the field of attachment, which is one of the most robust, if not the most robust in the history of psychology. She and John Bowlby together. Mm-hmm. She's often called Bowlby's student, which she never was.
She wasn't, yeah.
She was his colleague. Mary Ainsworth, she was not a believer in Bowlby's attachment theory until she saw it for herself in Uganda in 1954-55. And then she came to Baltimore and replicated that study. And that's where she developed The Strange Situation as a way to test the secure base behavior that she saw more strongly exhibited in Uganda than she did in Baltimore. And she figured, well, why would that be? And she thought, well, maybe it's because I'm the first white person these kids have ever seen, and so they're more naturally afraid. So let me take them into the lab and goose them into a little bit of fear. And so she developed this thing in what she says in about 20 minutes, where she, it's a series of comings and goings and reunions and separations to understand who a child is and what the nature of their attachment pattern is to their parent. So what happens when the parent is gone? What kind of reaction does the child have? And more importantly, how does the child return to their original state when the parent returns in The Strange Situation? And then she used that work to deepen her data from her Baltimore home studies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, one of the most full-on studies of developmental psych on Earth.
Yeah.
And just, so rich, so personal, so intimate.
Yeah, and it's such quite a genius move, I think, to move it into, to create this, what is known as the strange situation, because beforehand in Baltimore, she and her assistants, I think they spent like 72 hours with each family, just observing and cataloging everything. And then she could come to similar conclusions from a 20-30 minutes lab observation, which is quite amazing. And it did create such a plethora of other studies, and it's a very robust research paradigm, which is amazing. Yeah,
it is. And it's just it's such a crucible. It's such an incredibly elegant experience, The Strange Situation. So I fell in love with it as a poet. That's my original vocation. I've been, I have my master's in fine art as a poet. And that's my sort of view. I am not a psychologist. I am not a nonfiction writer to the degree that I became when writing this book. I see it that the original subtitle was going to be The Love Story of a Lifetime instead of A Mother's Journey into the Science of Attachment. Random House wanted that second one so that people could know what they were buying.
Yeah.
But I really hold fast to the first one. It's The Love Story of a Lifetime for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really resonates, both from the book and if people follow you like online, it really resonates in the work that you publish in your blog post. You see it's one of your passions.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
It certainly is.
Yeah. So maybe I know that you have this group that it's called The Secret Teachings of Mary Ainsworth.
Yes.
Maybe you want to share a little bit about what that is.
Sure. Yeah. I would be delighted to. So Mary Ainsworth, as we alluded in our conversation, she is often called John Bowlby's student, and she was not his student. She was an incredibly brilliant scientist in her own right who changed the world through this work that you're talking about, her work in Uganda, then Baltimore, then The Strange Situation. And specifically in her Baltimore studies, she came up with this document called the Maternal Caregiving and Interaction Scales. And mm-hmm. it's four different scales. I have it right here. I always forget. It's incredibly complex. I have it right here. It's like 20 single space pages.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is what she used in order. And there was only 26 families. Okay. This is a small sample.
Yeah.
So 26 families, they, as you said, you know, they cataloged their observations and had a little stopwatch with them writing down what they saw every 5 minutes. And so they have incredibly rich data. I have it on my computer, on my desktop. It's a 7,000 page PDF,
wow.
which is all of their.
And to think that they did this all with, you know, without computers like we have today to catalog everything and.
Typed it. Well, they wrote
like
it out.
Old times big data.
Exactly. Uh-huh. They wrote it out like Jane Goodall, you know, good old fashioned pencil on paper.
Yeah.
And then they had someone who typed it and then cataloged it. And they were looking at so-called critical situations, feeding, changing, crying, comings and goings, but really whatever was happening at 5 minute increments. And then, so then they had this incredible data. And then Mary came up with these scales and then took the data and viewed the mothers in the study through each of these scales and gave them a rating of 1 to 9. Mm-hmm. So the scales are sensitivity versus insensitivity to baby's signals. I'm looking through the thing right now. Cooperation versus interference with baby's ongoing behavior. It's a really interesting one. Physical and psychological availability versus ignoring and neglecting. She's so harsh. It's hard to read this stuff because it's like, oh, yeah. God. And then the last one is acceptance versus rejection of the baby's needs. So there we have, in my opinion, the most comprehensive exploration of what it means to love a person that I have ever read. And I have been a practicing Buddhist for many years. And to me, this is a dharmic kind of document, because she is talking in such incredible detail about the quality of, you know, all of these different scales, sensitivity versus insensitivity. It seems like such a simple thing, like you're sensitive or you're insensitive, but mm-hmm. au contraire, that is not how she understood it. She understood these things with such depth and beauty. It's exquisite and painful. And she rated these mothers on a scale of 1 to 9. Each one for each of these scales.
Yeah.
And that's how she began to understand secure versus insecure patterns of attachment.
So it was coming because in the strange situation, we are observing mainly the behavior of the child, but
yes.
here she's focusing on behaviors of the mom.
Correct.
Yeah, yep. she's coming from the parent place.
Yeah, and it sounds really harsh and judgy, and yeah. it certainly felt that way, but she was a professional judge. I mean, that's what she did. And she was observing and trying to understand what's going to behoove a secure attachment. Mm-hmm. So what we do, so this has been studied very, very infrequently. There are a couple of articles about it. Inga Bretherton writes about it. But, and, you know, sensitivity is considered a, you know, a prerequisite to attachment security for the most part in most of the literature. There's some, you know, complication around it, but generally that's accepted. But what did Ainsworth mean when she said sensitivity? That is glossed over. So what I have done is I've started this free study group monthly where we get together, me and a bunch of other attachment nerds, and just geek out over these maternal sensitivity scales. And the incredible thing that I have discovered is that it's one thing to read the scales about how we treat the child, but the really miraculous thing comes when we think about how we treat ourselves. So for instance, this, I'll just read the first paragraph, or the first little bit of scale 1, sensitivity versus insensitivity to the baby's signals. This variable deals with the mother's ability to perceive and to interpret accurately the signals and communications implicit in her infant's behavior, and given this understanding, to respond to them appropriately and promptly. Thus, the mother's sensitivity has four essential components. This is classic Ainsworth, like, just break it down.
Break it down, A, everything.
Oh, yeah. A, her awareness of the signals. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. B, an accurate interpretation of them. C, an appropriate response to them. And D, a prompt response to them. Let us consider each of these in turn. So what we do in the Secret Teachings Workshop, study group rather, is we read this aloud together, and then we change the pronouns so that it's about us. For instance, this variable deals with my ability to perceive and interpret accurately the signals and communications implicit in my own behavior, and given this understanding, to respond to them appropriately and promptly. Thus, my sensitivity has four essential components: my awareness of my signals, an accurate interpretation of my signals, an appropriate response to my signals, and a prompt response to them, to my signals. Let us consider each of these in turn. So we go through every paragraph and switch it to talk about, because you know the headline of all of this attachment research is that it moves, the transmission of attachment moves generation to generation through the parent. And the way that we are parented by, you know, our caregiver is how we, for the most part, parent our child. And so what I really love looking at is how we have internalized and interpreted the patterns of attachment that we've inherited. And so I just loved this work of taking it and applying it to ourselves to see, like, okay, am I sensitive to myself? Because it's a guarantee that if I am not sensitive to myself, I will not be able to be sensitive to another. Our sensitivity is our instrument. You know, we can't delight in someone else unless we are connected to delight. We can't connect to our sensitivity toward another if we don't have sensitivity on a very basic level. Yeah. And one of the hallmarks of a securely attached adult is that they value attachment. Mm-hmm. And so one way to become more secure is to think about it and to cultivate it and to become mindful of it and to, you know, to turn our attention in that direction. So that's what we do once a month. And it is so fun.
Yeah, it sounds like something that it starts from an intellectual, let's dive into these texts, but it can really quickly go to a very deep personal exploration, which sounds quite amazing. And I totally agree with this notion that if you want to really understand your child and show you how you care for your child and you know, provide what we call secure attachment or a strong bond or whatever you want to call it, it has to start with yourself. Yeah. And it's something that I see myself repeating time and time again with my clients and here on the podcast and other areas where I talk about it, because we are the source for our children. And if we are not, you know, if I forgot who was the Greek, you know, philosopher who said know thyself, which one of them was it, Aristotle's or Plato? But if you're not aware to yourself, how could you be aware? How could you have a real awareness into what is happening for your child? And they need us to have that viewpoint.
Exactly. You know, and this is what I've learned in my many years of Zen practice, is that awareness is simply a light within. And it's not like we can become aware of this jar without awareness in our minds. And the jar that I'm holding up in our Zoom call, listeners out there, this, I have no emotional content about this. So I'm not scrambling to, you know, address it or not address it or hate it or love it. It's not threatening to me. Put me in a position where I'm supposed to be aware of a screaming child who I feel guilty because I'm not giving them what they need. And they look like my uncle and they, you know, they've smeared ketchup all over and I'm enraged. And then I feel guilty for being enraged. And oh my God, like to be able to have awareness in a moment that is that filled with emotional content is a Herculean. And so our work is really to develop awareness. And so that's why the Secret Teachings Workshop is so fun, because we're talking about attachment. We're talking about this incredible text, which I call Secret Teachings because nobody ever knows about it. And we are, we're creating awareness. We're creating new pathways of awareness about the intricacies, the exquisite intricacies of love as per Mary Ainsworth.
I wonder what she would have to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I want to ask Bob Marvin to come and be a special guest one day, because he was her protege. I think he would just get such a kick.
And you know, when you talk about cultivating and developing this awareness to ourselves, for the sake both of the child and of ourselves as parents and human beings, reminded me of a post that I saw on your Instagram, and I saved it for this talk, so it aligns quite nicely. And I just quote it for a second, and because you really talk about that in there, so maybe we can go talk a little bit about that. So it says, instead of healing your attachment wounds, be compassionate towards them. Become an excellent informant on your own inner life, thoughts, and experiences. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about what does it mean to become an informant on your own personal life, and how do we do that?
Yeah, so the excellent informant is Mary Ainsworth's term. It's what she discovered was one of the few variables of what was in place that for the secure attachments in Uganda. So after she gathered all of her data and she went back to Baltimore and she was looking at all of her notes, she realized that some of these mothers had she had more rich data about some mothers than others. Mm-hmm. And when she looked again at the data with this in mind, she realized, she saw very clearly that the mothers who had the most juicy, coherent, detailed, beginning, middle, and end kinds of stories about their children happened to have secure attachments. Mm-hmm. So, that's not something that anybody has ever talked about before. But when I read that in Infancy in Uganda, I was like, oh my gosh, this is a precursor to the adult attachment interview.
Exactly. That was what I was going to say, because just for the sake of listeners, the adult attachment interview is a kind of interview that was developed later, I think, by Mary Main, who was her student. Yeah,
absolutely.
And one of the ways it works is by it's an interview when you ask someone to talk and tell about their parents, and the interviewer digs out information from the coherence and the way you talk about them and what you say, what you remember or not you don't remember. So it's really like being an informant of your own parenting.
Own experience. Relationships. Yeah. And what's really important about the AAI is that, you could be a lawyer and be incredibly coherent talking about the defense of some guilty or not guilty person. And then someone asks about your mother and you're like, past, present intrusions. And like, the tenses are changing and you're like, I don't remember. Or you like perseverate, there's so many ways that we can be incoherent. So it's really important to remember that it's not about just looking at how coherent people are in general, but mm-hmm. when you're talking about attachment relationships. I saw that and I would just said, oh my God, that is incredible. And so I've been using that as a way of inviting parents to become, storytellers about their children, which is another way of telling a story about yourself. Not that we don't exist outside of our children, obviously, but that, there's so much invisible force field around parents and children that is very difficult to, this is what you do in therapy, it's like parsing apart all of that chaos.
Yeah.
What is that?
Trying to shed light into the darkness.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And it's such a beautiful, difficult, painstaking process. And so I just use the term become an excellent informant as a way of inviting that. So that idea of instead of trying to heal your wounds, which is, trying to wrap it up, Mm-hmm. I say, let's become compassionate and get to know our wounds and become excellent informants. Like, what is it that triggers me? What is it? What does it feel like to be so-called triggered? You know, what are all the different aspects of myself, which is very difficult for mothers specifically to feel they have permission to explore. You know, yeah. It's one thing to like go and get a manicure and a pedicure as self-care. It's quite another to think, okay, I actually have the right to consider who I am, what I want, how I feel, what I like, what I hate, the life that I want to live, you know, how I want to spend my time. It's radical.
Yeah.
The truth is, it actually is good for your children.
So it's a very, very good reason to engage in that. Yeah. But it does bring me to think about a topic that we did want to talk about, which is shame. Yeah. Because when you engage in that, and when you think about your needs and your wounds and everything in between, and when you're putting your awareness in what is happening to you in front of your child, maybe when I can think of myself when I get so angry that I scream at them, and then I might be feeling guilty or shame. So how, maybe the question is, how do you see shame, or how Mary, I don't know if she talked about it, but how does it affect our ability to be this excellent informant on ourselves or our children?
Totally, totally. Such a great question. She doesn't talk about shame, but she doesn't use the word shame, but boy, does she lay it out. You know, when she talks about mothers who have all of these barriers around paying attention to their children, I think a lot of it is because they feel so much shame about the fact that they can't pay attention. Mm. And so it's, you know, it's the shame spiral. The minute you introduce, you know, what you just said was so beautiful. Sometimes I get so angry, I scream at them. And I'm not saying that's a beautiful action, but to be able to say that, a lot of people can't say that. Mm-hmm. For a woman to say that is like big deal. You know, I can't tell you the amount of people who tell me that my book was so brave because I just like said some things. I mean, I did not even say that much. Honestly, there's a lot more for that. All of that came from. But you know, we live in a culture that is really, you know, a patriarchal white supremacist, you know, all the ways that we squish people into these boxes it's not human. We don't value human experience and the depth of what it means to have all the feelings. Mm-hmm. So shame absolutely is the obstacle for becoming an excellent informant. When we're insecure, we feel a lot of shame. And so it just continues on and on and on. One of the reasons we are insecure in our attachment and in every other way is because we have been shamed, because we feel like we're not a lovable person. We don't feel lovable. So in order to get through that, we have to start seeing shame as a thing and not as our nature. And that is a challenge of a lifetime. You know, I'm a Buddhist, so I have the good fortune of believing very deeply that we have many, many, many lifetimes to work our stuff out. Like, I don't feel a huge rush that I have to get it right now. Not that I'm not trying really hard, because I know that I'm going to be happy and people will be happier. You know, we all are liberated at once. That's what the Buddha taught. But I understand that, you know, our karma is so big and so complex that it has to just keep going and going and going, and we're not going to work it out. And that's another, and that's a really, I find, a very supportive way of sort of de-shaming. Like, if I don't get it all right this time or now or today or however we understand time, it's, you know, it's okay. It's okay. It's human. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's a work in progress. And I think it's something that I find myself sharing with parents all the time, that, you know, you may have screwed up today. It doesn't mean you will screw up tomorrow. It doesn't mean you are a screw up. That it only means that you screwed up today. And if you have the ability to, maybe in Mary's words, be an excellent informant into your own experience. And I just had a conversation like that today with a client of mine. about how he was angry with his daughter for something that she spilled like a glass of water accidentally or something like that. And he was triggered by something else. And he saw her reaction. She was preparing herself already to be, you know, to be a little bit scolded or something. And in her, the look in her eyes made him stop and gather himself, which was beautiful and which was something he was never able to do a couple of months ago. But
kudos to you as his therapist.
Thanks. And then I talked with him about, you know, what I called a kind of debriefing, like him being able to sit down with her after everything cools down and share his own, like his own moment. I was really angry, out of proportion maybe, and take responsibility. And that is a very important hallmark of a secure attachment. The attachment figure, the parent, the caregiver, being able to take responsibility, even though it might trigger shame in them.
Absolutely.
And by the way, what a wonderful model it is for the child.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, just at the very beginning of what you're saying, we talk about this in the study group a lot. People, therapists, talk sometimes about how their clients come in and say, oh, I'm a screw up, I'm a this, I'm a that, and that so much of the work is about, no, you're not. And I always want to interrupt that. Of course, I'm not a clinician, so it's easy for me to do. I've been in lots and lots of therapy, and to say, you know what, maybe I am. Maybe I'm not like in a total, but like I spent so much time when my daughter was young, people telling me, oh, it's okay. It's okay. We all make mistakes. And I said, no, it's not okay. It is not okay how I am treating her. We sure other people make mistakes, but I don't want to do this. And I feel out of control and I need help. And I'm not, so the shame thing works in such subtle ways that we can look like we're trying to like protect someone or ourselves and say, oh, don't worry. It's okay. Everybody makes mistakes. It's true. We all make mistakes, and it's true. It's going to be okay, I guess, but maybe it's not going to be okay. Maybe, I mean, some people really do need to, they are really damaging other people. Yeah. And, you know, we live in such a fearful culture of emotional pain that I am, you know, I'm a big proponent of shoulds. I think we should not yell at our kids, period. I think we should treat our children with respect, period. These are my goals. This is how I want to live. This is the world I want my daughter to live in. And when I screw up, I want to feel, I feel like I will never get better. I will never become a better parent if I don't allow myself to feel her pain, my disappointment in myself, my healthy shame.
Yeah.
You know?
Healthy shame is really, it's a good thing that you put the word healthy there, because,
exactly.
You know, in psychology, we learn and we talk about how shame can be very toxic.
Totally.
Like it rots the soul from within. But healthy shame, sometimes it's important because it allows you to really look into yourself and again, take responsibility. And this is how you move forward.
Exactly.
Not shying away from your, you know, your blemishes.
Exactly. Well, that's why I love the study group, because we can't do it alone. We live in a patriarchal culture where women are absolutely not invited to have a full experience of their personhood. So I don't expect mothers who are listening to be able to just, you know, move into that healthy shame, because we are so conditioned to beat ourselves to a pulp. That's how women are trained. And so the thought that we could accept, like, oh, I screwed up today, and actually feel the pain of that, that's terrifying, because we associate that with total toxicity, like you're saying, where we're, you know, rotting from within. And that is not what I am talking about. I'm talking about having enough self-composure and support and, you know, a life that feels resourced.
Yeah.
Where I can say, you know, that's in a way, that's such an ultimate privilege to be able to say, wow, you know, I need to really work on myself.
Yeah. And that's a start of a journey.
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult to do. And most women are too busy, you know, just taking care of business to be able to do that, at least in the United States. I know in Israel, things are different.
Yeah. In some respects, yeah. But, you know, it's things to think that sometime people just will, you know, wake up one day and feel like it's too late. Like, my kids are too old for me to change now. And I'm kind of an optimistic kind of guy and psychologist. So I believe that, you know, people can change all the time, even at their 80s, if they want to, if Absolutely. They really want to and really will do the work. So yeah, you know, maybe someone who's listening right now, maybe they have older children, maybe their children are already, you know, left the home and living on their own, and they feel like how they think about all the mistakes they've done. It doesn't mean that you can't, you know, take this maybe newfound awareness and the new thing that you learn about parenting, because and use them and take responsibility and use them. Because it's funny, because when we talk about parenting, most of us, you know, in the parenting field, we talk about how you raise children. We talk about toddlers and teenagers. But as my mom likes to repeat time and time again, you stay a parent all the time. She's still my mom, and I'm still her little boy. Yeah, oh. Even though I'm 40. So
yeah. Yeah,
we keep, yeah, we keep on doing that. We keep on being parents. And it's, well, maybe it's, I think it's not just me, but I think it's never too late, you know, to think about that.
100%. I mean, well, in my book, I talk about my relationship with my father, who died many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Azalea has never met him. My daughter Azalea has never met him. And I had a very dark relationship with him. I did a lot of healing, which I talk about in the book, with my relationship with him after he was already gone. Now, I am convinced that relationship, that, you know, because these things move through generationally and so mysteriously, that my healing, my relationship with my dead father is going to be supportive for her moving forward with her children.
Yeah.
And so not only is it never too late, but we never know how things are transmuting and affecting people. And, you know, if we just continue to bring love into the world through our own sincere heart, we will just continue to bring love into the world. And there's no downside.
Yeah. There's no downside for bringing more love to the world. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. However we can do it, however we understand that, it's never too late, and there's never a reason not to.
All right. So I think this is a good place to, you know, wrap things up. Yeah. I want to be respectful for everyone's time. And again, thank you so much. I always have fun chatting with you.
Yes.
And just before we finish, maybe let our listeners know where they can find you if they want to learn more about your work and your book and other things that you do.
Yep. So I have a website, BethanySaltman.com, and I'm on Instagram, and that's been really fun. And so follow me on Instagram, and you know, I love hearing from people. I get a lot of really fun DMs from parents specifically, which I really enjoy. And then the Secret Teachings Workshop or Study Group is the second Tuesday of every month from 2 to 3:30 Eastern Time. If you go to my website to the Secret Teachings page, you can sign up and get the Zoom link and get on the mailing list and get, you can download Mary's Scales. You can come or not come. There's absolutely no commitment. I have hundreds of people on the list, and not that many people come every month. So it's just a really nice way to, you know, be gathering virtually around some important ideas.
Yeah. Awesome. Great. Yeah. And I'll put the links in the show notes as usual. You'll be able to find them on apparentlyparent.com. And yeah, and if you still haven't read Strange Situation, do it today. I love this book. So thanks again.
And yeah, thanks so much for having me and for doing this podcast, which is a labor of love, I know.
All right, so that was my conversation, my second conversation with Bethany Saltman. I really enjoyed talking with her. She has so much to share, and I do enjoy bringing people who are not what you tend to call quote-unquote parenting experts, so to speak, or, you know, psychologists such as myself or other parenting coaches or anything of the sort, to talk about their own experiences and their own journeys into becoming parents and what they discover about themselves in the process. And I think Bethany embodies that in a very beautiful way. And I know I can't say it enough, I guess. If you haven't read her book, Strange Situation, yet, go do that. It's a really wonderful read. It's easy to read, and it's moving, it's touching, and you'll learn some stuff along the way. I really enjoy that. If you want to learn more about the book, go to apparentlyberent.com/strange. And with that, let's close this episode for today. The show notes for these episodes are available on apparentlyberent.com/56. You will find all the relevant links over there. And as always, I will see you again next week. Now, if you are here still listening, please do me a little bit of a favor. I would really appreciate it if you go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and just rank this podcast with how many stars you believe it should get and leave a review. Those reviews really help me get in front of more people and get this message out. So please, if you would be so kind, I would really appreciate that. And with that, let's close this episode for today, and I will see you again next week. Bye-bye.